And so I'd like to start, if I might, with an important announcement with respect to the Juarez United States rule, because as the governor indicated, it's been a very important aspect of our focus at the agency, really since inception. In fact, it was February 28th of last year when the president signed in the Roosevelt Room an executive order to me to fix this WOTUS situation. And so we began the journey within 10 minutes after him signing that executive order. And we've been doing that since last year. Tomorrow, we're actually releasing the replacement definition of the Juarez United States rule. And so it's going to provide the clarity to farmers and ranchers and folks all over the country with respect to how federal jurisdiction, where it begins and where it ends. Because what we've seen from 2015 is a great deal of uncertainty. Land use was being impacted, land use decisions were being impacted in a very substantial way because you didn't know where federal jurisdiction began and ended. So we have gotten back to the basics on what that rule should be, what that definition should be. We've not reimagined our authority under the Clean Water Act. We've actually went to the text of the statute and gone to the case law and asked ourselves, what did Congress intend with respect to what a water of the United States is? And I will tell you, they didn't intend it to be a puddle, a dry creek bed, or an ephemeral drainage ditch. And as you know, that's how it was applied across the country. In fact, I've shared this with the governor. I was in Salt Lake City, Utah last year, as an example, standing outside of a subdivision that was being built in Salt Lake. And I was with an Army Corps of Engineers representative who looked at an ephemeral drainage ditch that made up a part of this subdivision being built. And he pointed to it and he said, Scott, that is a water of the United States. And I said, well, it's not going to be anymore. And so we have been in progress since that time to provide clarity, certainty on what the Juarez of the United States rule should represent. And navigability is going to be respected. It's going to be implemented in the rule. We're going to make sure that carries forward into the future. So I'm really proud of the work that's gone on at the agency, really proud of the effort to get this done in a timely way. We made a commitment to get this done in 2018 as far as a definition. So the process tomorrow, publishing this, you know, sending this to the OMB, will start that process to ensure that we have a definition that's solid, durable, and certain for you here in Nebraska and all of the country. So that's a very important effort, I think, by the office. And might I add this? I mean, I think what happened with that 2015 rule, we heard leading up to the definition being adopted in 15, that the reason the definition was adopted was to provide certainty. You know, that there was great confusion about these issues of federal and state jurisdiction and whether, you know, certain waterways were in and certain waterways were not in to federal jurisdiction. And so that was the impetus, that was the motive, that was the reason why we were told we needed a 2015 definition. The exact opposite happened. As you know, greater confusion happened. And so this is really the effort that we've engaged in at the agency. Folks have described this as deregulation. It's not deregulation in the truest sense. It's regulatory reform. It's regulatory certainty. It's taking a deficient rule, a rule that really didn't reflect the statutory framework, you know, that overreached and was not representative of what Congress intended, you know, and taking dry creek beds and puddles and turning them into waters of the United States. When that happened, you know, the opposite of what the supposed objective, you know, as far as clarity occurred. So this regulatory reform, that's how you save the economy $1 billion, which is what the agency's been about the last year, and also improve environmental outcomes. I mean, this is something that's being lost in the discussion. Environmental outcomes have improved. Air quality is up, 10% improvement with respect to ozone under this administration. More Superfund sites have come off the list, 3 times the number last year. There'll be 10 times the number of come off the list this year. Water quality, as far as lead in our drinking water, and focus on investment and infrastructure replacement to ensure safe drinking water. There's great momentum with respect to environmental outcomes at the same time that cost and regulatory burden is being decreased. You can truly engage in a common sense approach and achieve better outcomes. So it's exciting, you know, Governor, you know this, but 35 to 40 states that I've had these kind of discussions. And it's not just been, you know, recently. We've been doing this obviously over the last several months. We've been talking about the WOTUS rule and hearing from stakeholders all the country. Utah, the second most dry state in the country, a little bit different than Minnesota as far as the needs. And that's really what is important. Congress recognized you can't have a one-size-fits-all strategy in these kinds of things. You need to respect the role of the states and the issues particular to those states. And so that's what's being incorporated into the rule. And we're going to say what it is, what the United States is, but we're going to say what it isn't. We're proposing that prairie potholes in North Dakota are not waters of the United States, and we're proposing that groundwater is not a water of the United States, and that's going to provide the kind of clarity that's important to Nebraskans and folks all over the country. So I'm glad to be here at the Farm Bureau. You're a Farm Bureau, but Farm Bureaus all over the country have truly been tremendous partners, tremendous assets at getting the word out and understanding the importance of getting this rule right. So it's a joy to be with you to share that, and a joy to be with the governor to share that as well. I do want to touch on what's happened the last few days as far as where I've been and talking about issues that are important to you farmers and ranchers here in Nebraska. I've been in Kansas, been in South Dakota, and now Nebraska, this Heartland tour with respect to issues. And I know there are other things that you may want to talk about, but the RFS issue is something I do want to address because, in fact, I was with Green Plains this afternoon in Omaha talking about this issue. And I want to share a couple things with you. One, I'm hopeful that we, as an administration, working together can provide some certainty in the marketplace. It's needed with respect to the RFS. And this issue is a very challenging issue in many respects because decisions that are made affect various aspects of our economy, various states across the country. And so I want you to know that unequivocally, my commitment is to administer the statute and seek to provide clarity to you in the marketplace so that you know what's expected of you and you can allocate resources. I know it's very challenging right now in the farming and ranching community. I know that there's challenges from a trade perspective. There's uncertainty around NAFTA. There's uncertainty around the situation with China. I mean, there are markets that you have concerns about, and then you have the uncertainty with respect to the RFS. I understand that. And so part of what I've been doing the last several days is what I've done the last 16 or so months. That's sit down with stakeholders and talk and figure out how we can work together and find solutions. And so it's been very, very helpful to me. Very instructive to me. We've had some very good conversations over the last several days, and I look forward to those discussions here today. A couple things I would share with you with respect to the RFS. When I was going through the confirmation process, the biggest issue at the time, and Governor, you can echo this, I'm sure, was the point of obligation. There was tremendous concern about the point of obligation being moved. This administration said no. We kept the point of obligation right where it was from the very beginning. There were concerns that had been offered about the volume obligations not being published on time. And that was a meaningful concern because routinely the agency, though we're required to publish that every November, the agency didn't do that. In fact, there were 3 years running, the agency didn't publish any volume obligations. And the last time they did it, they combined all 3 years into one filing. That just simply shouldn't be. The agency should file those volume obligations every November pursuant to the statute so that you know what's expected for the following year. So we met the deadline last year. We're going to meet the deadline again this year. The other commitment that was made by the administration was with conventional ethanol was to keep it at 15 billion gallons. That's the statutory cap, as you know, and that's where it's been last year. That's where it's going to be this year. The volume obligations are actually coming out next week, and I think you're going to be encouraged by those RVOs, the proposed RVOs. Celiosis is going to be up. BBD is going to be up, bio-based diesel. The advanced category is going to be up. Conventional is going to stay at that $15 billion. Those are all good things with respect to this industry that you care about. So there's some encouraging things going on. The E15 issue, the RVP issue, before we arrived, was not even being discussed at the agency. It was not something being analyzed from a legal perspective, a policy perspective. It was not even on the shelf. I began that process last year, mid-year, to evaluate what authority we had from a regulatory perspective, because there was great question about whether the agency could actually act through regulation, whether we had to rely upon a statutory change or whether we could handle it internally. I've determined that we can move on that from a regulatory perspective. I am for the E15. I think it should occur. I think it makes no sense whatsoever for this country to face a situation where you can only sell a product 9 months a year. You should be able to do it 12 months a year, and that's going to help volume obligations. I want you to know that, and I've been there several months. In fact, I was in Iowa last fall and shared that with them and was unapologetic in that regard. The question has been, legally, can we achieve that? Now, I do want to say to you that many think that just by being for something, by being for E15, that you can do it like that. That's not the case. It's actually a rulemaking process. You have to propose this as a rule. You have to take comment. And then you have to respond to those comments and finalize the process. I actually have begun that process internally in response to the discussions at the White House. So that process internally, the review of putting together the meat of that proposal, is actually ongoing at the agency. Now, I've been, you know, asked to pause that because, as you know, there was discussion about a package between the export credit and the E15, and that broke down about 2 weeks ago. And so I've been instructed to pause that, but nonetheless, internal, we are continuing preparation just in case, you know, something comes out of these discussions, whether export credit's gone or not, if there's a package that can be put together, we want to be ready to respond to the E15. So I want you to know that, but also know that there's been a lot of discussion the last couple of days, and I'm sure from your perspective as well, about the small refinery exemption. There are some things that I want you to know about that, because there's a lot of misinformation in the marketplace about that. Number one, that is statutory. I don't make up the criteria by which those decisions are made. In fact, there's only certain companies that can actually apply. 75,000 barrels a day is the max. So if you produce more than 75,000 barrels a day, you cannot even seek the exemption. So these stories about, you know, large companies taking advantage of the small refinery exemption at the parent level, that just simply is not the case. It's a facility by facility review. It's based upon 75,000 barrels of production. And moreover, as we make those decisions, it's not a isolated decision. It's actually in collaboration with DOE. DOE has a job to analyze the data that's submitted by the refinery, and they actually go through a two-step process. They look at the structure of the refinery and determine whether there's any structural deficiencies. I'm talking about from a business perspective, and then they look at economic hardship as step two, and then they make a recommendation to the agency, to the EPA, on whether it should be granted or not. Every exemption that's been granted since we've come into this position has been in alignment with DOE, save one example, and that was just the difference between whether it should be a 50% or 100% grant as far as the exemption. So this is not being used as a tool to affect the RVOs. I just want you to know that unequivocally, that that's not the case. Applications are up because RIN prices have been up. If you go throughout history, we actually have a chart at the agency that shows when RIN prices are increasing, applications increase. And the standard is different than what has been used historically. And I hate to be this granular with you, but I hope it's helpful because I want you to know the process we go through. The applications have gone up because of RIN prices, and we are always lagging a year behind. Because when we set the volume obligations in November of each year, it's for the following year. So as we set them in November of 18, they're for 2019. And then the compliance obligation, where you pay the RINs, is in March the following year. So when we set the volume obligations in November this year, the compliance time will actually be March of 20. So the applications for exemptions actually occur in the second calendar year from the time that you actually set it. So we're always lagging about a year behind, which, by the way, is what causes the difficulty in reallocating those RINs. And that's been a part of the discussion. And so I've committed in this process, and I want you to know this, that we are looking at changing when the applications actually occur for exemptions to make sure that they're recaptured in the volume obligations that are set. So that if someone submits an application for an exemption, if it represents 200 million gallons of ethanol, those 200 million gallons are then recaptured in the volume obligation that is being set in November for that following year. So you don't see the situation where, you know, RINs have been released and they're not reallocated to others in the marketplace, which addresses, I think, the primary concern. So there are solutions that we are putting out there that I think will address those concerns, and I think there are legitimate concerns, and that's what I've heard the last couple of days. So I want you to know we've tried to be solution-oriented. This issue with respect to RFS is not Mideast peace, but it comes close. And it may be ours domestically. I'm not entirely sure, but there are a cross section of industries and groups and states that are impacted. There are passionate feelings about this issue across the country. I endeavor to try to find answers there and administer it fairly, and I want to hear from you in that regard. And that's what I've done the last 2 days. So I probably spent maybe too much time on that, but I wanted to give you a color, if you will, of the conversations I've had. Again, I was in South Dakota yesterday with about 125 to 150 farmers. Great discussion about this very issue, particularly about the reallocation. They were appreciative of that. And it's something that we can do, but will do. But we wanted to make sure that as we look at this E15 issue, just know that it's something I believe can happen from a regulatory perspective, that we've spent a lot of time on the legal side, and we believe it's authorized. It's been paired with some measure of reform for those refineries, those merchant refiners in other parts of the country. And the reason it's on pause is because those two things were paired together. And that's just candidly where we are. And I'm hopeful that is something that is fixed in the near term, and we can move forward across the board on reforms that impact this issue in a very constructive way. I know there are other issues, I'm sure, beyond WOTUS and beyond RFS that you want to talk about. Worker protection standard, obviously, is something that has been a big issue. Age requirements with respect to that, that's something we're addressing with rulemaking. There's a host of others, but I want you to know this above everything else. I believe the farming and ranching community, the last several years, your voice has been lost in the process at the EPA. And I made a commitment at the very beginning, and I make it to you today. The voice of farmers and ranchers across this country should be heard loud and clear, because you're our first environmentalist, you're our first conservationist. The greatest asset you have is your land. And you care more about the air and water quality than anybody else could. And I know that. And I will tell you, the agency historically, I think, has looked at you not as a partner, but at times as an adversary. And that's wrong. And we will achieve better outcomes together than the other. And we have been committed to that. And I'm going to stay committed to that. And I value your partnership, and I value your input. So thank you for the time of being here today. And I really appreciate the governor's participation and attendance today. And Steve, you're opening this up to announce something that I can't tell you how excited I am to get across the finish line on a definition with respect to WOTUS. It's there's a lot of hard work that's gone into that, and there were not many that believed that we could get to this point of providing an objective, clear a definition that will help land use decisions all over the country. But that's coming tomorrow, and I appreciate the opportunity to share that with you tonight. So look forward to your questions.
On the WOTUS issue, and certainly appreciate all of your hard work and all of the work of the administration to address regulatory reform in lots and lots of areas. As you talk about all of the processes that have to happen to basically deal with WOTUS, to get rid of what was initially proposed, do you see anything that can get in the way of that, that would either slow that down or somehow stop that? And I guess maybe just a little bit on your thoughts as far as timeline is to when we can sort of draw a line through it and say we're done.
Well, our goal with respect to the 2015 rule was to provide certainty and confidence to all folks across the country that 2015 rule was not going to be Lazarus and come back from the dead. You know, because that was something that was going to create confusion and uncertainty. So there were many things that we have done to address that. There were compliance dates that were part of the 2015 rule. We finalized a rule to extend those. That occurred in January of this year. That provided confidence, you know, and certainty to folks across the country. Clearly, we have the replacement definition that we're sending over to OMB tomorrow. Ultimately, that's the main thing. I mean, I think that folks across the country need to know that it's not, and this is important. I think, and I made reference to this earlier, oftentimes our efforts at the agency have been described as being deregulatory. That's not entirely reflective of what we're doing. Deregulatory action or deregulation is what? Getting rid of a regulation and then not replacing it. A vacuum, if you will, an absence of regulation. That's not what we're doing with respect to WOTUS. With respect to WOTUS, we're dealing with that 2015 rule that is something the courts have said is deficient. And so we're clearing the deck on that and providing clarity there. But then we're providing, as I indicated tomorrow, the substitute definition going forward, so people know. It's our job to do that, and that's what we're seeking to achieve. So it's my belief, Steve, that we've got a plan in place and a process in place that enhances secure knowledge that certainty is there, and that we're focused prospectively, not retroactively, you know, about that 2015 rule coming back into existence.
And so will the public get a chance to see that rule tomorrow?
Oh, yeah. No, well, that's a great question. OMB has a review process, Governor, and I appreciate you mentioning that. That will go to OMB tomorrow, and OMB will begin their review of that. They'll offer comment to us, and I can't tell you exactly what it may be 30 days. I mean, I don't know the exact time frame that will occur. But they will look at it, then they'll submit it back to us, and then we'll release that for public consumption. So that's not by our determination, by the way. That's what the OMB and the regulatory process require, is for us to send it over for interagency review, internal review, so that we can make sure. And it goes on anyway. I mean, we've talked to all of our partners from Ag to Justice and the rest, and they've looked at it in a substantial way, but this is required for us to get interagency comment before it's final and goes out to the public.
So if they take 30 days to review it and they get it back to you and you put it out to the public, how long will the public have to comment on it?
You know, that's something that's yet to be set. I would imagine it would be at least 90 days or so in that time frame. What's interesting about the comment process, it's like doing homework or taking a test at times. Whether you have 120 days or 90 days or whatever the days are, most people don't comment until like that very last day. So you can have 120 days and people are waiting to the 119th day, you know, before they give us any kind of comment. So sometimes it's not the length that matters. It's just you making sure that you have sufficient time to prepare the comments. And I think in the 2015 rule, there were over a million comments filed. So it was quite extensive, and we anticipate that happening again. But again, I want you to hear this. The 2015 rule and what we're doing now, the 2015 rule was not about water quality. It was truly about power. That was the full extent of what was. It was who was going to make land use decisions across this country. Because if a dry creek bed is a water of the United States, then it affects all land use decisions across the country. And the first place that you would have to stop to get permission to use your land, as you've always done historically, was going to be Washington, D.C. And that was never intended by Congress when the Clean Water Act was adopted. So that's why this is important to fix and to make sure that we respect, the federal government respects what our role is, and we also respect what the role of states, you know, represents, as well as private property owners. I mean, Jim knows this. There's quite a bit of state regulatory oversight of water quality in the state of Nebraska without us, you know, telling them to do anything. Nebraska cares about water quality just like, you know, the federal government does. So I think that was lost in the discussion, you know, back in 2015.
With the heat, the water is very vital to Nebraska and Nebraska farmers. Being a grain farmer, we know how important water is. But also important, is vital to Nebraska farmers, is ethanol. And
yes, sir.
We'll talk more on the E15. So President Trump, then candidate Trump in Iowa, he mentioned his support on RFS and ethanol. And again, in April, Governor Ricketts was there, and a congressional delegation was there too. Also, he to support, and he mentioned no mention of any package deals that was gonna happen. And thought he should move forward the E15, get year round. Question is, when do you see that? What's the timeline? When's the finish line? Where do we see that? Your support is there, but we'd like to see.
Well, let me say this to you. Which we had already begun the process even before the president talked about that, as you described. The issue with this presently is that there have been multiple meetings that have occurred over the last several months where multiple stakeholders have expressed various concerns about various issues, okay? And without getting into the specifics of those, the last meeting that occurred was an effort to put and pair changes with respect to small refineries, but the export credit, as you know, and then also the E15. That's what occurred out of the evolution of those meetings. And then that was paused. We stand ready to proceed. And I think that, I think at this point, the importance is, I've shared this with Green Plains this afternoon, I think there are folks across the country that want this to be accomplished, and there to be clarity across the RFS, and that's what we endeavor to achieve as well. I can't give you a time frame. I wish I could tell you that I would hear that tomorrow and know that tomorrow. We're just simply doing the work now to prepare, and I'm actually encouraged with the conversations that have happened the last couple of days, and encouraged this afternoon about. An opportunity to bring parties together. I mean, I'll share this with you because I think it's important to know. Several months ago, I brought representatives of both sides of the ledger together. I'm not going to share who, but they were major stakeholders on the ethanol side and major stakeholders with those on the refinery side. And I said to them, can you all get together and help us, you know, find an answer? They did, actually. and it didn't involve the export credit. There were other things that were proposed. E15 was in that mix. There is a way forward here. There is an answer that I think provides certainty to various aspects of the marketplace, all aspects of the marketplace. I think what's happened recently is that sometimes the politics, it's almost difficult to get over just the unwillingness to find answers at times, you know, and I actually am encouraged that that's going to be overcome this time, and that we're going to provide the kind of clarity. And E15 is one of those things. It's not a foregone conclusion, you know, that even if we go through rulemaking, we submit that there won't be challenges to it. There'll probably be challenges to many things that we do in this process. And so it's ultimately, you know, it will be borne out through the process, both rulemaking and any court challenges. But I feel confident that the statute provides for the authority to do it. There's a commitment to do it. I think just right now, because of, you know, the deal that was brokered and then how that just fell off, that it's just we're in a pause period. And I'm hoping we can hit play and get away from pause and provide the kind of clarity to folks across the marketplace. There's a desire to do that. I desire to do that. It's just that right now that's not where we are.
There seems to be a lot in the ag economy right now, a lot of pressure with the threat of tariffs. You know, we're in the middle of the crop season. There's a lot of pressure, low prices. We've been working on property tax. There's a lot of things going on, and it's just one more thing that we need to get straightened out. And everything takes a lot of time, but yet our bills still keep coming in.
Yeah, I understand. I mean, it's this process. We were actually on when we finished the discussions. Whenever that was, a month ago, time kind of runs together at times. We began that day, and we were trying to put on a fast track of 4 months. I mean, this summer season was never going to be impacted because it takes far longer normally than 4 months. And once a deal was brokered and confirmed, it was going to take at light speed 4 months. I mean, because you have to propose the rule, take comment, all the things we're doing on Lotus, you have to do on this as well. There are other things, by the way, in the package that matter. I mean, transparency in the marketplace. I mean, RINs are being held at times for years. There needs to be some reform with respect to that as well, transparency. There's great consensus there. There's great consensus on the impact that E15 will have on the marketplace, too, by both sides of the ledger. The issue is, when will it actually penetrate the marketplace? There are many that think it's going to take at least 3 years, you know, for it to really penetrate the marketplace and show progress. So in that 3-year period, you still have some other issues that you got to deal with on the RIN instability. And I'll tell you, I think that we need a stable RIN market. I mean, you don't want to see RIN prices spiking to 80 cents and dropping to it's just not good for anybody when that takes place. And to the degree that the RIN market is unstable, it actually, in my view, is a threat and an impact, adverse impact on the RFS as a whole. It's in everybody's best interest to get RIN stability. So that you can plan and allocate resources, and that's part of the discussion is trying to contribute to that.
So my understanding, if you produce more ethanol, you produce more RINs.
That's right.
You stabilize it that way. I'm thinking if this summer was out anyway, by next summer we should be.
And that wasn't our choice, by the way. That was just a timing mechanism. We couldn't get it done, you know, by the summer anyway. Even if we started.
So my hope would be to.
Next year.
Place and be rolling, and we have to educate the public that it's okay to be using E15. It's good.
That's right.
It's good.
That's right.
It works. We're in that game.
Now, the sorghum issue will impact this fall. Yeah, it will impact this fall. That pathway will impact this fall.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Next question.
When you talk about, when you talk about the RFS and the volume requirements and things like that, it seems like we always talk about ethanol, and I was appreciative that you mentioned the biodiesel too, because that kind of gets lost in the story.
It does.
We definitely need the required volume for biodiesel to be increased, because we've got the production capability of producing a lot more.
It's going to be.
And it's just going to help our industries a lot. They can know that they can produce more.
Those numbers will be now. This is a proposed number. Just like everything else, I have to propose the numbers, and then we take comment, and then we finalize in November. But the numbers will be in excess of what they were last year. On the bio-based diesel. Celiac as well. Celiac is going to be up.
If you can get that done and get this E15 thing done and the WOTUS thing done, I'll lobby for you to get the Peace Prize. You answered a lot of my questions already, I think, in your visits to other states, too. I'm a rural farmer as well. I work in an ethanol plant in Nebraska. My main responsibility is originating grain. And a gentleman here just, I think, drawed some of the attention, but you know, the producer industry right now is really concerned of the RFS and us meeting the RFS. As reminded, it's 15 million gallons. There's definitely a lot of questioning, you know, and I think you addressed some of it too, some of the waivers being given to the refiners. And that's a statutory decision. How do we maintain an RFS and meet that requirement when these waivers are still given, even if it is a statutory decision?
That's a great question, and that's the reason I probably went too fast in my comments. Sometimes I get to go in too fast as I talk, so I apologize. But I think what fixes that prospectively, you know, is, again, if an exemption is granted, whatever, let's say the exemption represents 100 million gallons, you know, so you get a 15 billion gallon volume obligation for conventional ethanol. You have an exemption that's granted that represents 100 million gallons. We need to restructure our timing by which we make those decisions to ensure that they're recaptured, reallocated in the volume obligation. You get what I'm saying? So right now, that's not happening, because those applications come in March, as I indicated, the November 18 volume obligation that's going to be set. Guess when we'll see applications for exemptions? March of 20, because that's when the compliance is. So there, you can't go. I've asked the question, actually, can we go back retroactively capture those RINs associated with the volume obligation? And I've been told by legal counsel that we can't do that. We can't go back retroactively. So the answer is to fix that prospectively, to change the timing by which those applications are decided upon. Now, I want to tell you also, we don't control the number of applications that come in. I mean, that's not something we choose. We don't encourage it. We don't discourage it. It truly is market driven, and I mean this loosely. It's in response to RIN prices being up and down and up and down. That's what drives it. And so when RIN prices are up, applications are up. When RIN prices are down, applications are down historically. So that's why, you know, there's been, I think, an increase. RIN prices are down right now, right? But the applications we're going through are for 2017. So that what's driving that is what the RIN prices were then. And then the other thing I'll mention, just so that I want to emphasize this, again, the standard is different. The standard by which we make the decision is different because of a court case. The EPA was sued by Sinclair and a group of refineries because the past administration said the standard was bankruptcy. So when the decisions were to be made on the exemptions, they were requiring bankruptcy before they would grant the exemption. And those companies sued the EPA, and the D.C. Circuit said, wrong standard. That's not what the standard is. You've got to apply a different standard, and that's economic hardship, which goes along with that DOT and DOE analysis I told you about. So two things have contributed and are contributing to this refinery exemption issue. Those are the two. Applications have been up and the standard has changed. And I will tell you, those two things have been used by folks in the marketplace to say that we're just simply sitting behind a desk just handing out exemptions. I can't do that. That's not what I'm able to do. I mean, I have to, you know, the application is controlled by who submits it. I have a statutory criteria. DOE has a role. And then all that's evaluated, and then they're issued or not. And again, there's been 100% alignment, save one decision, and that was to grant, but just a different amount of money. So all that being said, the only reason I mention that is because there's been communications in the marketplace quite the opposite of that, and I think it's important for you all to hear that, and that's what I've been sharing in South Dakota and Kansas, and that's been helpful to them. But the way you deal with this going forward is to change the time that you consider and then grant those applications, because then that will recapture the RINs associated with that exemption. The ultimate answer, in my view, is to provide RIN stability. There's no way that we should say that it's good to have RIN prices at 80 down to 30 down to 15, back to, that is just, it's not good for anybody, in my view. And we've got to make changes to our policies to ensure more stability in that regard. And that's why the discussion is taking place on how to do that. And as that discussion is taking place, it's created, you know, some uncertainty. So I hope to fix it and want to fix it. And look, I'm not proprietary to any particular idea. We have to propose it just like everything else. What I've tried to do is bring stakeholders together. To me, it is not wise in this kind of situation. I made the reference earlier, it's like Mitty's piece. There is not an ideal solution with respect to this issue. There just isn't. If you make a decision that is heavily weighted on one side of the ledger versus the other, it impacts a certain sector of our economy in a very, very damaging way. We have to be contemplative of that and then make decisions pursuant to what the statute says. And so my approach has always been bring those people. You know, Todd Becker at Green Plains knows his business far better than I ever will, just like Joe Gorder at Valero. Both have a vested interest in this issue. It's better for me to bring, you know, people that understand these issues and then we bring our team. Let's talk about how we address this with real solutions. That's what we should be devoted to. And that's what I think that's what's good about. I mean, leaning into this issue is important. It doesn't happen often. I mean, this statute was around in 06, 07, you know, and there we need to lean into it, provide the kind of confidence and certainty to folks across the country so that they know what, you know, long-term stability of the RFS will be achieved.